So when one starts investigating conspiracies, suddenly, by the same principle, facts backing up the conspiracy seem to pop from the woodwork.
Oh, yeah. It's like the Law of Fives created by Kerry Thornley before he started remembering or imagining his connection with the CIA and brainwashing programs and so on. The Law of Fives holds that everything in the universe is directly connected to the number five. Sometimes I restate it as given enough ingenuity on the part of the interpreter, but usually I leave that out and leave it in Kerry's form and leave the reader to figure it out for himself. But take, for instance, 666, the number of the beast. How the hell is that connected to five? Well, add it up. 666 adds to 18. 18, 1 plus 8 equals 9. 9 is 3 squared. There you got your 3 and your 2. 3 plus 2 equals 5. You see how easy it is? That only took 3 steps.
So because the mind is searching for those kind of connections, it's putting them together wherever it can.
Yeah, I'd like to do a book sometime on great wonders by intelligent people. Because when you start looking for something, you tend to find... this wouldn't be like Simon Newcomb, the great astronomer who wrote a mathematical proof that heavier-than-air flight was impossible and published it a day before the Wright brothers took off. I'm talking about people who found a pattern in nature and wrote several scientific articles and got it accepted by a large part of the scientific community before it was generally agreed that there was no such pattern. It was all just selective perception. This happens over and over. And if it happens to scientists, imagine how much more often it happens to artists.
Can you give us an example of one or two conspiracies that you actually think are probably true?
The Kennedy assassination. I've never been satisfied with the Warren Commission. None of the Kennedy assassination buffs have convinced me that they got the right explanation, but I do feel there was some fiddle-faddle going on there, especially in relation to the wounds. You can't read the report from Parkman General Hospital at Dallas and the report from Bethesda in Maryland that evening without seeing the body was altered. The Parkman wounds, as described by them, seemed to fit what the doctors there thought it was, two shots from the front. The Bethesda wound seemed to fit the Warren Commission theory of three shots from the rear. And the body was altered. The wounds changed their size. They changed their location. I don't claim to know who did it or why or anything like that. That's where every Kennedy assassination buff loses me. After they knock holes in the official theory, then they give their own theory, which doesn't sound any more plausible than the official theory. I don't know what happened, but I think there was a lot of deception of the public going on at that time. One theory I have considered, which most conspiracy buffs don't like because it's too tame. Maybe all that was going on was that Oswald, like quite a few other defectors, genuinely defected to Russia, let's say, as hypothesis. We can make a more complicated one. He only pretended to defect and was working for the CIA all along. But let's say he genuinely defected. He got disillusioned. He wanted to get out of Russia. He went to the State Department. They said, "We'll help you get out. But in return, you got to work for us and pretend you're working for the KGB when you go back to the States." And so he's working for the KGB and the CIA at the same time. This is very common in espionage. It goes on all the time, the double agent system. Licio Gelli was working for the Gestapo and the Communist Underground, both during the Second World War. In the 1970s, while he was running the Pay Due Gladio conspiracy out of Rome, he was being paid by both the CIA and the KGB. This is very common. So Oswald comes back, he's working for two intelligence agencies, and for one reason or another, he cracks up, he gets pissed off, whatever you want to say, he decides to commit an assassination, and he does it. Everybody's trying to cover up his connection with their agency, and so all the evidence gets twisted around to cover up the connection with their intelligence agency. And there was no conspiracy at all, except a conspiracy to conceal the fact that he was working for more than one intelligence agency. That's a minimalist Kennedy assassination conspiracy theory. I know a lot more dramatic ones than that, but they don't quite convince me. That one doesn't convince me either, but it's more plausible than most, I think.
What other cases can you come up with that you feel are probably true?
On a scale of 1 to 10, I would put around 9.5, the closest to the absolute truth in my system of thought, that the government of the United States and most other governments, quite a few other governments, are largely controlled by the rich. And the democratic elections do not change anything because you're offered always a choice between two people, or as I say these days, my latest terminology, two lying bastards, both of whom are in the bag to the same major corporation. So it doesn't matter which one of them you vote for, the major corporations are going to be running the government. Like I said, I give that a 9.5. Maybe somebody got elected without getting millions of dollars from the major corporations, but I haven't heard of it. Usually the third-party candidates who don't get contributions from the big corporations, they not only don't get on the major media, but the major media mentions them only in passing to say third parties never win. That's the only thing you ever hear about third parties on television. It's about the only thing you ever read in news, but third parties never win. That's not true. We've had several cases in American history where third parties emerged as the new second party. But they keep telling us third parties never win, and they don't let us hear what the third parties are saying, because they want us to be stuck with the, not a choice, but a dilemma, to quote John Anderson, between two guys who are both in the bag to the same major corporation. So whichever one we elect, the corporations will still be running the country.
Bob, how do you find that conspiracy theory is related to literature?
Well, I suppose most of the epics have a conspiracy theory in them. The Odyssey is all about Odysseus's attempts to get home, and Poseidon's endless conspiracy to get him stuck on one island or another where he can't get home from. The Divine Comedy is all about Satan's conspiracy against God's plan. So is Paradise Lost. Conspiracy is a constant theme in Shakespeare, the history plays, the tragedies. It reaches the point in Hamlet where Hamlet has one of the shortest speeches in Shakespeare. Seeming. Nobody knows what's real anymore. There's so many conspiracies going on in Denmark, you know. And, of course, conspiracy is very big in modern literature, even before Illuminatus. It's in all of Pynchon's novels. If you read them all, they're all different aspects of the same gigantic conspiracy, which is never quite identified. Of course, Moby Dick can be regarded as a conspiracy theory. As Ahab says, be the white whale principal or the white whale agent, I will wreak my vengeance upon him. He's not sure that the white whale is the source of malice, or the white whale is just an agent of some supernatural source of malice. But in either case, the whale is the visible target. All visible things are but masks, as Ahab says. Now, there's a good motto for a conspiracy theorist. All visible things are but masks. That's for the more occult conspiracy theories.
Do you think it works the other way around, where conspiracy theory can contribute to or inform literature in some way?
Well, by the time you get to Hamlet, you've entered what Mary McCarthy very intelligently called epistemological tragedy. The whole problem of Hamlet is trying to find out what's real. Can you trust the ghost? Is he a goblin damned who is trying to lead Hamlet to his own destruction? Or is he really the ghost of Hamlet's father? Or is he just a hallucination because Hamlet is losing his mind? And then there's the more vital question raised by Oscar Wilde. Are the commentators on Hamlet really mad or only pretending to be mad? I think conspiracy theory is a very good training for thinking in non-absolute categories. Of course, most conspiracy theorists never get there. They think in absolute categories. They have the one true conspiracy theory. But if you study conspiracy theory from a sort of anthropological angle, which I sort of think is what I'm doing, at least that's the way I define it for myself, it's a great learning experience. You compare one conspiracy theory with another and see which ones are the nuttiest and which ones seem the most plausible. And you find the ones that seem most plausible have their nutty elements in them, too. It's like urban folklore. It's like reading the Weekly World News. You run into these things that are so crackpot, you can't believe that anybody could possibly have actually printed them and circulated them. like Our Lady of the Flowers in Long Island. I forget where. One of those little cities in Long Island, there's this woman who channels the Blessed Virgin Mary, and she announced that the Vatican has been taken over by Satanists, and Archbishop Lefebvre should be the next pope, and that Jesus himself invented AIDS because he was so pissed off at the gay community. And because Jesus invented it, science will never find a cure for it. And I would love to see that with a cartoon of Jesus with one of those cute little white gowns they always have him wearing and a couple of test tubes cackling like the mad scientist in an 80s movie. Say, this will kill off a few million of those goddamn fags.
Do you have any other favorite theories that you've heard recently?
Well, besides Lyndon LaRoche's theory that I am the head of the Illuminati, Lyndon has also contributed the absolutely wonderful, one of my all-time favorites of the field of nut theories. Queen Elizabeth personally sent Alan Watts and Aldous Huxley to the United States to corrupt us with Oriental religions and drugs.
What's the payoff for her? I'm just curious.
Then Britain will become the major power again after we've been destroyed by Oriental religions and drugs. And you can see we're being destroyed faster every day, right? You know, everybody says when they talk about religious tolerance, we're all equal, Protestant, Catholic, or Jew. And yet the curious thing is that there are more Buddhists in this country now than Jews. Protestants in first place, Catholics second, agnostics third, Buddhists fourth, Jews fifth, and then we got the Hindus and the Sikhs and the Mormons. But anyway, agnostics are pretty high up, and since I'm somewhere between an agnostic and a Buddhist, I'm somewhere between third and fourth place. I'm ahead of the Jews anyway. Oh, yeah, then there's the Christians Awake in Birmingham, Alabama. They believe Ronald Reagan not only was not a real conservative, he was actually a gay Freemason. And he was the head of a gay Freemasonic conspiracy, which was secretly engaged in filling the government with communist agents and pretending to oppose abortion while actually strengthening the power of the abortionists.
God, you know, it all makes sense now. You know, one of the most popular, I guess you could call it conspiracy theories, and it's almost more like a whole genre of conspiracy theories recently, is the whole extraterrestrial phenomenon. I mean, it's reached almost unbelievable proportions. What do you think is behind all that?
It's been growing since the 1940s. The first UFO abductee was Bugs Bunny in a cartoon called Hasty Hare in 1948 or 9. And then human abductees began to appear. And then Bud Hopkins arrived on the scene with scientific hypnosis, or at least what he called scientific hypnosis. And he found any place where he could find somebody who could remember being abducted by extraterrestrials, he could find three other people in the same neighborhood who had the same experience, if he put them under hypnosis often enough. And so it's been growing. There are so many variations on it, though. There are the extraterrestrial rapists. In a galaxy far, far away, they get into some really vicious neurochemicals every now and then. They say, hey, let's get into the flying saucer and zoom across 10 galaxies and have another go at Whitley Strieber's ass. Then there's the Joe Simonton case. That's another of my favorites. He was a heavy drinker, which is one reason for doubting him. On the other hand, he never tried to capitalize on his experience or make any money out of it or go on radio shows. He called the Air Force and told them that a UFO landed in his backyard and some critters got out of it. I forget how he described them. And they asked him for some water. He brought out a bottle of water and they handed him a plate of pancakes, took off with the water and never came back. And when the Air Force investigated, he had these pancakes from outer space from somewhere. They actually took them to Wright-Patterson Air Force and analyzed them and found out they were very heavy in wheat germ, which indicates that whoever baked the pancakes was a health nut from outer space or from here. But what I love about this story is that Hynek, the guy who invented the swamp gas theory, He interviewed Simonton extensively and came away convinced that whatever happened, Simonton really believed in what he was saying. Does that mean he had too much to drink that day? I don't know. Jacques Vallée also interviewed Simonton and concluded he believed in what he was saying. There, that leads me right into the Jungian theory. Carl Jung believed the UFOs were an eruption of archetypes from the collective unconscious. And Jung never did make that too clear, but I think he attributed it to the Cold War. He felt we were living in times of such tension that the whole collective psyche had to change. And according to Jungian theory, for that to happen, there's got to be a lot of archetypes escaping from the collective unconscious. And, in fact, a lot of extraterrestrial stories have a lot in common with traditional themes like the fairy folk of France and the British Isles and the demons, especially the sex monsters from outer space, the rapists from outer space. That's very similar to the incubi and succubi of the Middle Ages. Monks in the Middle Ages were frequently tormented by female demons who would have sex with them in their sleep, and they wouldn't know about it till they woke up having an orgasm. Monks were afflicted by this for hundreds of years. I don't know if it ever happened to any married men. It happened occasionally to nuns, too. They were called succubi instead of incubi. It was male demons who were screwing the nuns. It's happening now all over the country. It's the same phenomenon. So do they come from hell or from outer space or from the collective unconscious? John Keel believes they come from what he calls ultra-terrestrials. He says they've always been around. They're not inside us or outside us. They don't relate to in or out the way we understand them. And we can't get rid of them. And they'll always plague us and we'll never know what they are. Nobody likes John Keel. The Orthodox believers and the skeptics both hate his books, you know. I find them refreshing and amusing.
So on your conspiracy theory scale of 1 to 10, let's start with at least just the existence of extraterrestrials that come to Earth.
I would put that above 5. No, not that come to Earth. I would put the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence above 5. But that's a personal gut thing as well as a scientific thing.
But the
scientific evidence is very ambiguous. Yeah. But it does seem like Jodie Foster said in Contact, it seems like an awful waste of space if we're the only intelligent beings in it. And what Carl Sagan called billions and billions of galaxies, each of them with billions and billions of solar systems, you know. And then it depends on how you define intelligence. The older I get and the more I study nature, trees, dogs, chipmunks, seagulls, dolphins, ants. The more I become convinced that intelligence is a multifaceted thing and human intelligence is only one type, and to think human intelligence is superior to all other forms of intelligence is sort of like the delusion that I'm the best-looking guy on the planet, you know. It's a kind of mass narcissism. So I see intelligence everywhere, so that's another reason for thinking it's not only on this planet, but scattered all over the universe. Whether it ever came here or not, I don't find the thought preposterous, but I don't see any conclusive evidence yet that we've been visited.
So of everything you've heard, you don't think any of it is?
Not conclusive. Mm. Some of it is more heavily suggestive than others. And I noticed the French government recently came out with a report taking the extraterrestrial hypothesis very seriously. I think that's the first time a government has taken that position. I don't reject the extraterrestrial theory. I just don't feel it's been proven yet.
You know, since your book about conspiracy theory called Everything is Under Control came out a few years ago, have any new theories come to light that you find particularly intriguing?
I more and more see the czarist element in this country, how it's taking over more and more aspects of American life. Now they're paying television shows to slip in government propaganda in the middle of alleged entertainment. That's a typical czarist tactic. I'm more and more convinced that when they selected a czar, they knew just what they were doing. I think the czarists have very largely taken over this country. We're living in a Dostoevsky novel. We're not in a Kafka novel, after all. We're in a Dostoevsky novel.
Something you've written about extensively, Bob, is the P2 conspiracy. Is that something that is still going on as far as you're concerned?
Well, I'd put that around 8 on the scale of probabilities. P2 in Italian, or P2 in English, it's short for Propaganda Due, which is named after Propaganda Uno, which was a socialist conspiracy within the Masonic movement of Italy in the 19th century. Propaganda Due seems to have been a fascist conspiracy within the Freemasonic movement in Italy. There's a lot of conspiracy theories about Masons, and as far as I can figure out from all my research, such as it is, Casanova hit the nail on the head when he said there's nothing conspiratorial about Freemasonry, but many conspirators have joined Freemasonic Lodge and used them for conspiratorial purposes. That's what Jelly did when he got to the third degree in the Grand Orient Lodge of Egyptian Freemasonry. He then formed Pei Due, starting out with only those who had reached the third degree, and then recruiting others, because part of the rules of Pei Due, you had to make a full confession of all your sins and crimes to your master to show your absolute faith and solidity with the brotherhood of Pei Due, or P2. And then Jelly used all that to blackmail other people to force them to join Pei Due, or P2. And by the time the whole thing blew up, it turned out there were 950 members of the Italian government who belonged to Pei Due, as well as most of the chief bankers, and Calvi and Sindona were just the principal ones. First of all, for the benefit of those not aware of Pei Due at all, around 1982, a whole bunch of people got indicted in Italy as part of this conspiracy. And what they were doing, among other things, they were doing bombings which were attributed to the Red Brigades. This was part of the CIA's Gladio project to turn Italian politics to the right. And so they were doing bombings and making the left wing look like a bunch of crazy bombers. They were also assassinating left-wing politicians, and they were laundering cocaine money from South Africa and heroin money from the Mideast through the Vatican Bank, the Banco Ambrosiano, the Franklin National Bank, run by Michele Sindona, and the Cisalpine Bank in the Bahamas, run by Roberto Calvi, who owned the Banco Ambrosiano. And the Cisalpine was owned by Calvi and Archbishop Marcinkus, who ran the Vatican Bank. And it seems the cocaine money from South America went through the World Finance Corporation in Miami, then it went to the Cisalpine Bank in the Bahamas, then it went to the Vatican Bank, which is the economic equivalent of a black hole. Anything that goes in there never comes out again. Bank examiners can't get in because, as I said, it's not on Italian soil. Well, in the course of the investigations, Roberto Calvi was found hanging from a bridge in London, and I've written about that in 3 or 4 books, and just lately somebody finally confessed that he did it. He was a mafia hitman, and of course he had no idea why he was killing Calvi. It's not polite to ask why if you're a hitman. You're told who to kill, and you go and kill him. You don't ask why. That's, I think that's bad manners.
But
so we don't know
hanging,
why.
Hanging from a bridge?
Yeah, with his pockets stuffed with bricks. The first book on the Calvi mystery was called The Strange Death of God's Banker by Della Forte. He got the answer right at the very beginning. He said the mafia did it, and they put the bricks in Calvi's pockets to make it look like the Freemasons did it. Because the first degree initiation in Freemasonry, you swear that if you ever betray your brothers in the craft, may you be hanged where the rising tide covers your dead body with your pockets stuffed with bricks. And Calvi was hanged where the rising tide did cover his dead body before he was found. But it seems the mafia did it, but why they did it, nobody knows yet. Probably they suspected Calvi of shortchanging them on one of the dope deals, and probably they were right. Calvi was an interesting person. You can't find a single photograph of him with glasses, and yet he owned 4 pairs of glasses for 4 levels of sight. But every time he saw a photographer, he never had a pair of glasses on. That indicates a high degree of vanity, I would say. He never read much. But whenever literature was discussed, Calvi would always say the same thing. There's only one book you have to read, The Godfather. That's the only book that tells you how the world is actually run. And apparently he was right, or at least the world he lived in was run that way. Michele Sindona, who ran the Franklin National Bank, which was part of the drug laundromat used by the CIA and the Pei Dui and the Galen apparat and this whole underworld drug espionage network. Michael Isandona was convicted in New York of 65 counts of stock and currency fraud and the faking his own kidnapping to evade trial. And then after that, he had about a 3 or 4 year battle not to be extradited to Italy when they went to put him on trial for murder. He was defended by Richard Nixon's law firm, which is quite interesting because he was a guest at one of Nixon's inaugurations, too. And when he got back to Italy, he was convicted of murdering a bank examiner. And while he was awaiting trial on further charges of being involved in the so-called Red Brigade bombings, he died in his cell, either of self-administered poison or a poison given him by somebody else. Some accounts claim he cried out, "They've poisoned me." Other accounts say he just fell over without saying anything. It's like the Calvi thing. There was an argument for a couple of decades whether that was suicide or murder. The day Calvi was strangled and hung from the bridge by the mafia, his secretary fell or jumped or was pushed out of the window of the Marco Ambrosiano main headquarters in Milan. And there's a lot of strange coincidences connected with Pei Dui. Licio Gelli, who's generally considered the brains behind, or at least the Italian side of it, the real brains was James Jesus Angleton back in Langtree, Virginia, counterintelligence. Langleton was the first one to own a paper shredder in Washington. He may have invented the paper shredder. He believed there was a Soviet mole in the CIA of a rank at least as high as his own. And every night before he went home, he shredded everything in his office so the Soviet mole couldn't go through his papers and find out what he was working on. Angleton was running Gladio from Langtree, but Gelli was in charge of the Italian phase of the operation, and Galen was running the German and Soviet section. The World Finance Corporation in Miami was indicted by the DA of Dade County for knowingly laundering drug money. The word knowingly is very important because everybody who's researched the subject has come to the conclusion that everybody in the banking business is laundering drug money these days. It's a question of whether they know they're doing it or they're doing it unwittingly. Chase Manhattan was involved in some of these things. Nobody could prove they knew they were dealing with drug money. Money travels back and forth between banks, and most of the time they have no idea of its ultimate source. That's why Calvi invented 200 totally non-existent banks to help launder his money, but they went through a lot of real banks, too. The DA found out that 8 officers of the World Finance Corporation were former CIA agents. Now, a former CIA agent means 2 things, depending on how paranoid you are. If you have a naive, trusting mind, like 1/4 of the population still has, according to the statistics I quoted before, that 3/4 don't trust the government. If you trust the government, a former CIA agent means somebody who once worked for the CIA and now he's doing something else. If you read enough novels about the spy world, there are enough true books like The Double Cross System in World War II. You find out that a former intelligence agent is usually still on the payroll, but he's being paid through a numbered bank account in Switzerland, and he's still working for them. But they want to make sure that if he gets caught, it can't be traced back to the agency he's working for. That's when they're doing really criminal activities. So the World Finance Corporation was run by 8 former CIA agents who either gone into the drug business on their own or were working for the CIA after officially being severed and were laundering all the cocaine money from South America, which then went to the Cisalpine Bank owned by Archbishop Marcinkus and Roberto Calvi, then to the Vatican Bank, then to the Banco Ambrosiano, then through 200 ghost banks. Nobody knows where most of it landed. Although when Gelli was busted in Switzerland, there was a warrant out for his arrest in Italy, but they couldn't arrest him because by the time they got to his house, he had left Italy because the head of military intelligence was a member of P2 or Pei Dui also. He tipped Gelli off that they were coming to arrest him. So Gelli took a plane to Uruguay, and after a few months, he crept back to Europe and tried to get some money out of one of those numbered Swiss bank accounts. The Swiss arrested him. They recognized him, and they put him in one of their top security prisons. Now, what I find fascinating about this, I've done a lot of travel in Europe. Everybody in Europe will tell you the Swiss have the most incorruptible police in the whole continent of Europe. Yet they only held Gelli for 48 hours. Within 48 hours, he was out of that maximum security prison and on another plane back to Uruguay, a mystery which has never been explained. And when I was in Geneva, which is where the prison was, I suggested they should put over the door of the prison the three monkeys with the see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, and the motto, ficken sie nicht mit pay due, which being translated in English is don't screw around with the Freemasons. No, don't screw around with the Italian Freemasons, anyway, not nowadays.
The Freemason connection is interesting because it's also there in sort of your theme conspiracy, which is the Illuminati.
After 30 years approximately of researching this, I have never found any reason to believe in a Freemasonic conspiracy. But I do believe that, as I quoted Casanova, Freemasonry being a secret society has been used for conspiratorial purposes at times, like the Jelly case and the Adam Weishaupt case, which so many right-wingers in this country have never forgotten. Adam Weishaupt died over 200 years ago. But he had a secret society within Freemasonry called the Illuminati, which seems to, as far as you can judge from the more reliable historians, was devoted to plotting to institute in Europe the kind of democracy that was instituted in this country by the Constitution. According to the right wing, it wasn't that simple. What he really wanted to do was establish a socialist dictatorship with himself as dictator. And after 200 years, it's pretty hard to get through all the controversy. Thomas Jefferson called Weishaupt an enthusiastic philanthropist. But that's misleading because enthusiastic in the 18th century meant pretty much what bonkers means today, a half-crazy philanthropist. Adam Weishaupt formed the secret society within Freemasonry, which was almost certainly plotting to overthrow monarchy and institute democracy and maybe socialism, maybe anarchism, something, and was also very seriously devoted to overthrowing the Vatican.
And how far did he get with this?
Not very far as I can figure out, but a lot of right-wing conspiracy buffs believe the Illuminati took over the banking system of Europe and then took over the banking system of America, and they now run the whole world.
So it's so successful, they're still around.
Yeah, well, the way I look at it, if there was one group running the whole world, things would make more sense. I believe there's at least at minimum two conspiracies, and probably as many as 24 at any given time.
You know, it often seems that you're, in a way, satirizing the whole field of conspiracy theory.
Oh, very definitely. But I satirize everything. You know, William Burroughs was one of my favorite writers. In two of his books, he has a couplet up front without giving the source. And I met him so many times, I never remembered while talking to him to ask, did you write that yourself, or where did you get it from? The couplet is, lesser kings the name of party know. Where I come in, I kill both friend and foe. And I think that's the motto of every true satirist. You shouldn't play favorites. I satirize my own ideas as much as I satirize anybody else's ideas. I believe it's unsafe to be too sure of yourself, so every one of my books turns around and satirizes itself before it's over. After I get through demolishing everybody else's, I demolish my own.
Have you ever written a book that was fully self-satirical from beginning to end?
In some sense, they all are, but I can't think of one in particular.
So you're not picking on the conspiracy theorists in specific?
I think a lot of conspiracy theorists, besides the ones who think I'm a CIA disinformation agent, a lot of conspiracy theorists like my works. They just want to correct me on a few minor points that I haven't gotten right yet. I think I've been much harder on Christian fundamentalists than I've been on conspiracy theorists. And the funniest thing is, well, I wrote one book satirizing PSYCOP, the Committee for Non-Scientific Non-Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. And just one book out of all the books I've written. They still hate me for that, and they still think of me as their principal enemy. They are very sensitive. Very sensitive, very defensive, and very paranoid. They have the biggest conspiracy theory of all, which is that almost all the scientific research on so-called psychic phenomenon for the last 100 years at thousands of universities all over the world, it's all a conspiracy of wishful thinkers who are deliberately distorting all their evidence. And they know this because they don't do any experiments themselves, so they can tell the truth without having to get messed up by confusing data like the psychic investigators
do. They just already know it's wrong.
Yeah, they know it's wrong, so they don't have to investigate. That is the most enormous and hilarious conspiracy theory around, especially if you start reading some of the classic papers on parapsychology, which none of them have ever read. You can tell from their writing. They never read The Enemy because that might corrupt them.
What's the payoff for being a sort of one-sided conspiracy theorist?
Payoff is that you belong to the elite that knows the truth and you feel superior to all the idiots who haven't figured it out yet. I think that's the real kick in the Jehovah's Witnesses. I once did an article about the Jehovah's Witnesses for a news magazine, and I went around with two Jehovah's Witnesses from door to door. They knocked on the door and tried to get in to sell their line. Most people slam the door in their face, but they're infinitely patient because they're doing the Lord's work. So they go to the next door, and one out of six will leave the door open for a little while, talk to them for a short time. About one out of 20 will let them in and seriously listen to their arguments. And I watched all this, and then afterwards we had lunch together. I did a whole morning with them, and I got asking them about some of their crazier doctrines, and I saw how much it meant to them that they wouldn't take blood transfusions for their children, and they'd rather let their children die. That seems monstrous and insane to most of us. But to them, that makes them superior to the rest of us because we're too dumb to see how evil blood transfusions are. They're better than us because they can see it and we can't. And that's why people believe a lot of crazy things. It makes them feel superior to the sane people who can't see it the way they see it. It's like Sartre again, the anti-Semite and the Jew. Anti-Semitism gives you a tremendous psychological advantage because almost everybody you meet disagrees with you and tries to straighten you out. And you can feel superior to them because you know the truth and they don't.
So a psychological power edge.
Yeah, well, it's also very close to what Leary said about emotional politics. The most emotional person in the room controls everybody else because you got to respond to their emotions one way or another. You know, if we had a third person in this room throwing a temper tantrum and denouncing us both as Satanists or communists or something like that, we couldn't ignore him. We'd have to deal with his emotional tantrum rather than an intelligent conversation. So the most irrational person in the room sort of dominates, especially if they're claiming that Martians are putting poison gas through the keyhole, you know?
Did the good Dr. Leary have any conspiracy theories?
Yeah, he believed there are 24 conspiracies wherever you go. He identified them at Harvard and found the same 24 at Folsom Prison, except that they spoke better English at Harvard, but it was still basically the same 24 genetic types.
So these are the 24 types from Neuropolitik?
That's right, yeah, the 24 types of nervous systems. Mm. People with the same imprints in their nervous systems tend to flock together and work for the same goals. And when I find that people with the same imprints as myself, we call it an affinity group, and we talk about how we're improving the world. When somebody we don't like does it, we call it a goddamn conspiracy. The real difference between a conspiracy and an affinity group, I mean, the objective difference is how much lying do you do and how much deception do you do. I don't care what you're conspiring to achieve. I don't care what the hell your goal is. If you're not lying and deceiving, I don't think it should be called a conspiracy.
Well, let's talk about that. What makes a conspiracy by definition?
Theory of games and economic behavior by von Neumann and Morgenstern, they point out in poker, business, and war, the two basic laws are to get more accurate information than anybody else and to give as much inaccurate information as possible to everybody else. And you can see how that works in business. Private detectives who are always solving murders on television in real life, they spend most of their time stealing secrets from one corporation for another corporation to meet them and getting the product on the market sooner. That's what most private detectives work at. It's industrial espionage. They got to know more than the competition, and in war, that's what intelligence is all about. An intelligence agency is trying to figure out what the enemy intelligence agency is trying to deceive them into believing and what's the real truth behind that, which is where the double-cross system comes in. A good deception system has what looks like a plausible story, which the opposition will never believe if they find out it came from you, and you don't want them to know it came from you. You want them to think it came from India or or from Mars or somewhere else, but not from you. If they figure out it came from you, they won't believe it. So you got behind that another story that looks even more like the truth. Once they pass through the first, they're likely to believe the second. And I think that's another facade, too. And in poker, you do it all the time. People are always trying to convince others they got a stronger hand than they have. Or sometimes if they got a really strong hand, they keep bidding low to keep the bidding going on. So the bidding will get higher and higher until it reaches the point where they suddenly they put a really heavy bid. Everybody either folds or sees them, and since they got a really good hand, they rake in the pot. So the definition of a conspiracy is what von Neumann and Morgenstern call the basic laws of zero-sum games, which is make the other players believe things that aren't true and try to find out for yourself what really is true. And since everybody is playing the same game in poker and in business and in war, you're constantly being deceived. And so that tends to produce paranoia in itself, doesn't it? That's why I'm reading a book right now called Non-Zero, which is based on the idea that we're evolving toward a non-zero-sum society on a global level. I'd like to see that happen. I think zero-sum games bring out the worst in people. Not only lying, but I was suspecting everybody else of lying. Well, as Henry Kissinger said, anybody in Washington who isn't paranoid must be crazy. I would say anybody in the modern world who isn't a little bit paranoid must be crazy. You're being lied to all the time. You're being manipulated and lied to and deceived by so many people who are professionals at it that I don't see how anybody can evade some degree of agnosticism. They may not be as agnostic as I am, but they've got to have some degree of agnosticism. It's been exposed over and over again how the CIA lied to President Johnson during Vietnam, how advertisers lie to us all the time. They put things on the ballots in California that have titles that are the exact opposite of what the law would do if the voters were dumb enough to vote for it. It's part of zero-sum games.
So a conspiracy is a group of people who are trying to do this on purpose.
Well, they're in a game. It happens to be a zero-sum game, and you win by either knowing more than your opposition or making sure your opposition knows a lot that isn't true.
But so by that definition, it's not necessarily illegal or secret. It's just...
But it always involves deception and spying. The way you find out is by spying. Like in poker, you constantly watch the other players' faces to see if something crosses their face that gives away the fact they have a better hand than they're acting like or a worse hand than they're pretending to have.
Bob, would you like to leave listeners with any parting thoughts?
Amor et hilaritas, love and cheerfulness. And when you think of amor, think of Richard St. Victor saying, ibi amor ubi oculus est, where there is love, there is correct vision. And when you think of hilaritas, or cheerfulness, think of Gemisto Python. Gods can be recognized by their cheerfulness.
This concludes session 4. Our program continues with session 5.